And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. Sorry for the late start. 2 minutes after 6 o'clock, time for Off the Wall. Okay, that's about enough of that. Again, my sincere, humblest apologies for showing up late. I actually was only 2 minutes late, but still, it was frustrating because, well, for those who don't know, it's snowing a little bit here. And I mean a little bit. There's maybe a dusting on the ground. But mayhem, utter complete chaos and mayhem on the highways. Some of it justified, most of it not. They had a police barricade going down a hill, and I realized as I got to that particular location that it was sheer ice, and it was a good thing that they were barricading people. Probably somebody had gone down there the wrong way. But then there was this kind of chain effect of panic that followed that, where people were just going 10 miles an hour, 5 miles an hour, and these were on roads that were already salted. They were completely clear, but yet I was stuck behind somebody doing literally 7 miles an hour on Route 25A for about 5 miles. And they took away the passing lanes because, well, passing lanes are dangerous. Because if you pass and you don't go back into your lane, you hit the person coming onwards. And apparently we've lost that part of our brain that tells us to get back into our lane. So they had to take the passing lanes away. It's part of the whole dumbing down of America. I was stuck behind this person for a good 20 minutes, just going 7 miles an hour. And it was really, really annoying and frustrating. Now, you know, if you are completely mortified by the idea of driving in any kind of precipitation, stay home or go someplace that doesn't require you to get in a car. Have somebody else drive you. And I'm not saying by the other extreme that if you think that you're impervious to the elements and can go 60 miles an hour on an icy road. No, don't do that either. But they're both dangerous. They're both dangerous because, I'll tell you, you know, there's a line of people. I finally was able to turn off, and this person's still going. But there's a line of people probably about 2 miles long behind this one idiot who is going 7 miles an hour, stubbornly gripping the steering wheel and digging their fingernails into it, causing a lot of hostility and heartache behind them. And somebody's going to take the law into their own hands and launch into the air or something. I don't know. But yeah, so I was probably the only person trying to get to a radio show in that particular crowd. But I made it. That's the important thing. And I don't want to focus on this too much. Just kind of giving you an excuse why. I think that might be the first time I've ever been late for this show. Right? I think maybe I missed one. Yes, that's right. I missed one time. But as far as showing up late, yeah, this is a good excuse. Anyway, it's kind of cool. Kind of cool that we have snow finally, but it's not really very much. And it's going to turn to rain later, they tell us, so we can never win. But regardless, that's neither here nor there. Today is yet another day in the primary chain in this country, the weird way that we elect people to office. But there's something different this year. Have you noticed this? It's actually gotten exciting. It actually has gotten really interesting. I find myself caught up in it because you want to see just how, and I'm talking about the Democrat side, the Republican side's kind of dull and boring because we all know John McCain's going to get the nomination. He's way ahead. There's just a little bit of sniping going on back and forth between various people. Okay, that's a little fun to watch. But the real interest is in the Democrat field, where it's Obama versus Clinton. And what's happened in the past week has been simply amazing. It's hard not to follow this. I know there are people out there who are stubbornly not following it. Probably the same people driving 7 miles an hour on a road. I will not get influenced by this. They're all evil. They're all bad. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to watch TV. I'm not going to read. I'm just going to sit in my dark room and be gloomy all the time. Well, okay, fine. Do that if you want. Probably not listening to me anyway. But I can't help but be fascinated by the way this is going. Last week was Super Tuesday, Super Duper Tuesday, as they call it, because more states than ever before had primaries on the same day. And I was watching the returns after the show last week, and I expected Clinton to win. And I think overall she did win. Not by very much, though. Not by very much. I was watching various states come in with their results, and I was very surprised. I was surprised that Obama was doing so well. I figured it would be the usual thing where Clinton just got this lead with 0.01% of precincts reported. You ever notice this? She would have a lead, and then that lead would just stay. It's like everybody votes in the same percentages. Insurance companies love this. I don't understand how it works, but yeah, you take a random sampling of the population, and then you multiply it by a million, and guess what? The random sampling is accurate. Never can understand how that works. That's what I figured would happen. It's not what happened, though. The state of Missouri was going Clinton's way, and at the end of the day, it was won by Obama. And in other states, like Idaho had an 80-20 percentage for Obama over Clinton, 80% to 20%. How insane is that? So while Clinton won the bigger states like New York and California, Obama won a lot of the other states, and he won by huge margins. And now, over the weekend, what happened, there were a bunch of other states, like Louisiana, and Washington, Nebraska, Maine, and Obama won every single one of them, and he won them all by healthy margins. Now, he was expected to win Louisiana, expected to win Washington, not so sure about Nebraska, and nobody was sure about Maine. In fact, people expected Clinton to win Maine. But she didn't. Obama did, and he won by a good margin. Now, what has happened is momentum. We have this thing called momentum that has built up. And it's really bizarre and strange because obviously people in other states are affected by the way people in previous states have voted. I mean, if you just had one primary on one day where everybody voted at once and nobody knew what anybody else was going to be voting for, then there's no way those other people would be able to affect them. This is sort of the reason why they don't like it when TV networks make predictions before the polls close. Why they don't like exit polls that are used to predict who the winner will be. But in effect, what you have now is you have this election in slow motion that takes place over the course of months, state by state. And if something changes, like what's happening here, if something changes, it also changes the perception of people who might not have voted in that particular way down the line. So now, as a result of all these victories in a row after Super Duper Tuesday, victories on Saturday and Sunday in Maine, Nebraska, Washington, and Louisiana, all of a sudden, Obama is on a roll. Clinton is in trouble. She had to replace her campaign manager the other day. There's rumors that the campaign is bankrupt. She had to put $5 million of her own money into it. All these news reports are kind of snowballing into Clinton is in trouble. Now, here's a story that was in the New York Times this morning. Hillary Clinton and her advisors increasingly believe that after a series of losses, she has been boxed into a must-win position in the Ohio and Texas primaries. Those will take place on March 4th. I can hardly wait, really. She has begun reassuring anxious donors and superdelegates that the nomination is not slipping away from her. She held a Buck Up the Troops conference call yesterday with donors, superdelegates, and other supporters. We'll get into these superdelegates in a moment. Several said afterward that she had sounded tired and a little down, but determined about Ohio and Texas on March 4th, way down the pike. Now keep in mind, tonight, this Tuesday, February the 12th, 2008, there are three more primaries. Virginia, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Obama is expected to win every single one of those as well. So you see, the momentum keeps building up. And I don't know. I guess Clinton is being smart by assuming she's going to lose these primaries. But at the same time, I see her on television talking about how her husband, back when he was running for president, tended to lose the caucuses because the caucuses are run by activists for the most part. They don't necessarily represent the will of the people. So yeah, losing all these caucuses, that's not a big deal. I see her saying that while she's losing primaries and not saying anything about losing the primaries. Now tonight, three primaries. She's expected to lose all three of them, probably by a healthy margin. So that's something to take note of. Anyway, continuing with this story, the people listening to her her phone call said they had not been especially soothed. They believed she might be on a losing streak that could jeopardize her competitiveness in those states being Ohio and Texas, the ones she expects to win next month. Nothing this month. According to one superdelegate who has endorsed Mrs. Clinton, and who spoke on condition of anonymity to share a candid assessment, she has to win both Ohio and Texas comfortably or she's out. This is from somebody who has endorsed her, and she has to win those two states by a comfortable margin. Can't be close. And this anonymous source said the campaign is starting to come to terms with that. And campaign advisors also speaking privately in order to speak plainly. This must be a Times way of categorizing anonymous people. Campaign advisors confirmed this view. Now, several Clinton superdelegates whose votes could help decide the nomination said yesterday they were wavering in the face of Mr. Obama's momentum after victories in Washington State, Nebraska, Louisiana, and Maine this last weekend. And some said that they, like the hundreds of uncommitted superdelegates still at stake, might ultimately go with the flow, in the words of one, and support the candidate who appears to show the most strength in the primaries to come. So, yeah, the Clinton campaign in big trouble. No question about that. And as we mentioned, she has replaced her her main campaign coordinator. So that means something when things like that happen. Now, these superdelegates, this is the weirdest part of the whole thing. Superdelegates are various, there's no other way to describe them, party insiders. People who, people like Bill Clinton, for example, he's a superdelegate. He gets to vote. He doesn't have to have his vote tied to any popular opinion whatsoever. Who do you think he's going to vote for? I mean... He's not going to lose anything if everybody in the country wants Obama and he votes for Clinton. His vote carries a lot more than any of ours. Everybody listening to this show at once, we could all vote for one candidate, he could vote for another, and he has more of a say. And there's no penalty for this. There's something like 800 superdelegates, majority of which, so far, are for Clinton. So you could have a situation, and this sure sounds familiar, where Obama gets the popular vote... And the superdelegates decide who the nominee will be because it's so close. I was looking, if you look really hard on the internet, you can find lists. You can find who these people actually are. A lot of them are representatives, some are senators, some are just, like I said, party insiders. Here in New York, let's see who we have as superdelegates. Oh, look, there's Dennis Kucinich. He's a superdelegate. He was also a candidate up until a few weeks ago. Senators in, well, New Jersey, we have Frank Lautenberg, nothing in New York, no representatives in New York. Bunch of governors are, superdelegates. Nobody, in New York either, though. Howard Dean, chairman of, the Democratic Party, he's a superdelegate. He gets a special vote. Here's some other names. I have no idea who these people are. Lottie Shackelford, Linda Chavez, Susan Turnbull, Mark Brewer, Andrew Tobias, Alice Gurman, Philip D. Murphy. These are all listed as DNC members. There are also a few that are vacant. I don't know if those are up for grabs, if I can just waltz in and say, hey, I'll take that. I'll take that seat. But there are some ones that just are blank. They say vacant under various... various positions. These are just DNC members. Here are some in New York. Actually, a handful in New York. The Honorable Herman Farrell Jr., Dennis Mihail, that's M-E-H-I-E-L, Honorable Robert Ramirez. I guess if you're honorable, what is that, you're a judge or something? Or just a really nice person? I don't know. I mean, I could be honorable. I can play that, right? Huh. All right. Next time I get an airplane ticket and they have that little scroll down menu where you get to choose if you're Mr., Mrs., Ms., Father, I'm going to put honorable, see what happens. Sir, you're not honorable. You'll have to get off the plane. Yeah, that could happen. Let's see. Honorable Robert Ramirez, Irene Stein, Sylvia Tokaz, that's T-O-K-A-S-Z. I'm not spelling the name so you can look them up and call them at home and hound them to vote the way you want to vote. I'm just spelling them because I... might be saying them wrong, and I don't want to offend anybody. Let's see. There's so many of these. 800, about 800 people that just get this special treatment. I mean, how do such crazy laws and ways of doing things ever come to be? The Electoral College, superdelegates, the whole primary system. Then you got former DNC chairman. Yeah, they still get to be superdelegates. David Wilhelm of Illinois, Deborah DeLee of Massachusetts, Paul Kirk, also of Massachusetts, Roy Romer of Colorado, Bob Strauss of Texas. Unreal. Then you have the National Conference of Democratic Mayors, Honorable Kwame Kilpatrick of Michigan, vacant. He's not vacant. There's a vacant seat right below him. Democratic Association of SOS. I don't even know what SOS is. I mean, I know of about 100 things that are SOS, but I don't know what this particular one is. They include Honorable Robin Carnahan, Honorable Ray Bill Bradbury. Wow. How about that? National Association of Democratic State Treasurers, the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, Honorable Joyce Beatty, It just goes on and on. Young Democrats of America. What are these, kids? A kid's superdelegates? David Hart of Texas, H-A-R-D-T. See how young that Democrat of America is. I'd like to know. Crystal Strait, S-T-R-A-I-T, of California. You have the Democratic Association of Attorney Generals. Only one person on that, the Honorable Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada. National Democratic Ethnic Coordinating Committee, Christine Warnke of Washington, D.C. And finally, the National Democratic Seniors Coordinating Committee, vacant. Yeah, nobody's representing the seniors here. So, yeah, it's all crazy. It's all mad. All insane. That's our system. But I got to tell you, like I was saying, it is interesting seeing how Obama is just moving forward. And, you know, not to put too much faith into any candidate, but I have not seen this kind of support, this kind of passion, this kind of hope behind anybody ever that I can remember on the presidential level. I really can't. I'm thinking back. Let's just eliminate all the Republicans right there, okay, because I just cannot understand that at all. But let's look at people like John Kerry. Let's look at Michael Dukakis, Al Gore. You know, it just, yeah, there were people who supported them, but it was never this kind of a groundswell from all sorts of people of varying backgrounds and races and upbringings and things like that. I mean, here we have a situation where the country can actually make a radical change in perception. And again, you know, some people get on me for this because I'm talking about perception. I'm not talking about the actual issues. But if you look into the actual issues, such as net neutrality, for instance, you'll find that Obama takes a very strong position on that. He says some very important things about the war. He says some very good things about health care and all sorts of things like that. And of course, so does John Edwards. He says some really good things. Of course, he's no longer a candidate. But the issues are there. The issues are being covered. And for people who do want to change, I think they will find it in that particular candidate. They'll probably find them in Clinton as well. But what they see in Obama is just somebody who is not your normal candidate. Do you realize only three African-Americans have been elected to the Senate since Reconstruction? And I'm not talking about New Orleans. Yeah, it's unbelievable how things are tilted in this country. So even if you get somebody elected to the highest office in the nation, who is of a different religion even. Remember Kennedy? That was somebody who's Catholic. Oh, my God, are we ready for a Catholic president? To get to that stage, to get to the stage where, okay, you know what? Just like on 24, we have an African-American president. Let's move on. And he's not a divisive sort either. He's not speaking only to one race and not to another. In fact, he's not speaking only to Democrats. He's also speaking to Republicans and independents, trying to bring people together, which is smart, which is what somebody running the country should try to do, not be divisive. And it's also interesting, too, how everybody says that Barack Obama is black. You know, he's only half black. Yeah, his mother was white. His father was black. So he's half white, half black. But everybody calls him black. Nobody calls him white. But what better a symbol of uniting races than have somebody who's half black and half white in the White House? Wow. And then you have the fact that he has Muslim roots, lived for a period in Indonesia, middle name Hussein. Like I said, you know, this is the kind of thing that the rest of the world looks at and says, wow, it's not going to be Bush again. It's not going to be just another white-haired old white guy. These people actually are capable of thinking differently and giving something else a chance. And you can say the same thing about Hillary Clinton, too, and that's also definitely a milestone if we elect a woman for the first time. But when I hear her speak and when I see the things that she focuses on and what she's done in the past and the way she's kind of done 180s on certain positions when they're not politically convenient, makes me a little bit cautious that Okay, yeah, she'll be a woman, but she won't really be any different. I'd like to hear what people out there think. We'll be taking phone calls, 631-632-WUSB, in just a little while. I'd like to, first of all, lambaste another candidate, because that's what we're here for. And you're going to hear all sorts of critiques and commentaries on this station and many others in the months ahead. And that's what we're here for, to give you all sorts of perspectives. But I do think that this is an historic year, a very historic year, because change is definitely in the wings. And it just would be, I think it would be very cool to see somebody who is behind overtake and win with this kind of groundswell, with this kind of support. People voting who have never voted before. Massive turnouts like we've never seen. To me, regardless of what the actual issues are, to me, just that spells hope. People who are excited and getting part of the process, young people being involved for the first time. And even if the person that you elect with all of that support turns out to completely go against everything that you believe in and completely shafts you and betrays your beliefs and your trust, even if that were to happen, the mere fact that you were able to organize, unify, get people together, and make a change, make a perceived change, get somebody elected who would not have been elected without that support, that has got to be empowering right there. That's got to be a good feeling. I think this country is due for that. We're due to not feel hopeless, to not feel like we never have any power, we never can do anything. So it sure would be good just to have the feeling that, yeah, we're responsible for this. Okay, maybe it was a bad idea. We won't know that. We won't know that until actually things start to happen. I don't think it will be. I think it will be, of course, after 8 years of Bush, you know, you could elect the guy who cuts, who slices meat down at the supermarket and have him in power, and I think things would go better. Nothing against butchers. I think they'd make fine presidents. Just saying, almost anyone would do a better job. And I don't think many people are going to disagree with that, Democrat or Republican at this point. All right, getting to this other candidate. Got a bunch of mail, and I've talked to a bunch of people about this too, about this whole Ron Paul thing. Now, Ron Paul, as you know, is still running as a Republican with the other two, Huckabee, who has no chance, obviously, and McCain, who's most definitely going to be the nominee for Republicans. Now, it bothers me. It bothers me because so many people I know are buying into this Ron Paul nonsense. Now, he brands himself a Republican. First of all, I'm of the belief that anybody who brands themselves a Republican, after all the crap that we have been through, all the thousands of lives that have been spent as a result of their stupidity and maliciousness in starting this war and invasion and occupation, not to mention all the other things I could go into, anybody who puts that on the end of their name, regardless of whether or not they think the party has been hijacked, okay, the party's been hijacked, you know what, call yourself something else. You call yourself a Republican, you're not going to get elected. Not after this. And I think we need to hold people to that. All right, so that's number one right there. Number two, while some of the things that this guy is saying are nice, anti-war talk and all that, if you dig a little deeper, you'll see that a lot of it isn't as clear-cut as you might think. And of course, I'm referring to these newsletters that came out from the late 80s and early 90s. This was featured in the New Republic. And I was able to go to their website, take a look at some of the excerpts from the newsletters. And I've brought this up to a number of people, and invariably, these otherwise intelligent people tell me that, well, people change over the years. Come on. Let's listen to some of these comments. This is in 1992. He had a bunch of newsletters, the Ron Paul's Freedom Report, Ron Paul Political Report, the Ron Paul Survival Report, and the Ron Paul Investment Letter. And these have come out since 1978. Not all of them have been published while he was in office. There was a time when he wasn't in office, but the newsletters still came out. Anyway, this is a special issue on racial terrorism, which came out in 1992 following the Los Angeles riots. Quote, order was only restored in Los Angeles when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks 3 days after rioting began. What if the checks had never arrived? No doubt the blacks would have fully privatized the welfare state through continued looting, but they were paid off and the violence subsided. Here's what was said about Martin Luther King, a world-class adulterer who seduced underage girls and boys and replaced the evil of forced segregation with the evil of forced integration. The January 1991 edition of the Political Report refers to King as a world-class philanderer who beat up his paramours and a flagrant plagiarist with a phony doctorate. February 1991, the X-rated Martin Luther King. October 1990 edition ridicules black activists led by Al Sharpton for demonstrating at the Statue of Liberty in favor of renaming New York City after Martin Luther King. The newsletter suggests that Welfaria, Zooville, Rapetown, Dirtburg, and Laziopolis would be better alternatives, and says next time hold that demonstration at a food stamp bureau or a crack house. Okay, had enough with anti-black sentiment. Let's go to the gays. 1990 newsletter notes that a reporter for a gay magazine certainly had an axe to grind, and that's not easy with a limp wrist. June 1990 issue of the Ron Paul Political Report. I miss the closet. Homosexuals, not to speak of the rest of society, were far better off when social pressure forced them to hide their activities. August 1990. Bring back the closet. January 1994 edition of the Ron Paul Survival Report states that gays in San Francisco do not obey the dictates of good sense. These men don't really see a reason to live past their 50s. They are not married, they have no children, and their lives are centered on new sexual partners. They enjoy the attention and pity that comes with being sick. Wow. He goes on, support of survivalist militias, November 1994, the newsletter celebrates anti-government militias. January 1995 issue of the Ron Paul Survivor Report, released just 3 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, cites an anti-government militia's advice to other militias, including, don't fire unless fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here. This is unbelievable. The October 1992 issue of the Ron Paul Political Report paraphrases an ex-cop who offers this strategy for protecting against urban youth. If you have to use a gun on a youth, you should leave the scene immediately, disposing of the wiped-off gun as soon as possible. Such a gun cannot, of course, be registered to you, but one bought privately through the classifieds, for example. Had enough? Well, let's look at conspiracy theories a little bit. He's into those as well. Another thing that a lot of intelligent people seem to fall prey to. In 1978, Ron Paul newsletter said the Trilateral Commission is no longer known only by those who are knowledgeable about international conspiracies, but is routinely mentioned in the daily news. 1986 newsletter names Gene Kirkpatrick and George Will as two of our enemies and notes their membership in the Trilateral Commission. In an updated solicitation letter for the Ron Paul Investment Letter and the Ron Paul Political Report, Paul writes, I've been told not to talk, but these stooges don't scare me. Threats or no threats, I've laid bare the coming race war in our big cities, the federal homosexual cover-up on AIDS. My training as a physician helps me see through this one. The Bohemian Grove, perverted pagan playground of the powerful, Skull and Bones, the demonic fraternity that includes George Bush and leftist Senator John Kerry, Congress's Mr. New Money, the Israeli lobby, which plays Congress like a cheap harmonica. All right, you know, enough of this. Enough of this. I would like to read a little bit of an editorial that appeared, an opinion piece that appeared in the New Republic in January, also focusing on this Ron Paul issue. If you are a critic of the Bush administration, chances are that at some point over the past 6 months, Ron Paul has said something that appealed to you. Paul describes himself as a libertarian, but since his presidential campaign took off earlier this year, the Republican congressman has attracted donations and plaudits from across the ideological spectrum. I think this was probably written last year because his campaign has been going for a while. Anti-war conservatives, disaffected centrists, even young liberal activists have all flocked to Paul, hailing him as a throwback to an earlier age when politicians were less mealy-mouthed and American government was more modest in its ambitions, both at home and abroad. In the New York Times Magazine, conservative writer Christopher Caldwell gushed that Paul is a formidable stander on constitutional principle, while The Nation wrote of his full-throated rejection of the imperial project in Iraq. Former New Republic editor Andrew Sullivan endorsed Paul for the GOP nomination, and ABC's Jake Tapper described the candidate as the one true straight talker in this race. Even the Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the elite bankers whom Paul detests, recently advised other Republican presidential contenders not to dismiss the passion he's tapped. Now, long before he was the darling of anti-war activists on the left and right, Paul was in the newsletter business. In the age before blogs, newsletters occupied a prominent place in right-wing political discourse, with the pages of mainstream political magazines typically off-limits to their views, National Review editor William Buckley having famously denounced the John Birch Society, for instance, hardline conservatives resorted to putting out their own less glossy publications. These were often paranoid and rambling, dominated by talk of international banking conspiracies, the Trilateral Commission's plans for world government, and warnings about coming Armageddon. But some of them had wide and devoted audiences, and a few of the most prominent bore the name of Ron Paul. Now, they've carried different titles over the years, Ron Paul's Freedom Report, Political Report, Survival Report, but they generally seem to have been published on a monthly basis since at least 1978. Now, Ron Paul, an OBGYN and former U.S. Air Force surgeon, was first elected to Congress in 1976. During some periods, the newsletters were published by the Foundation for Rational Economics and Education, a nonprofit that Paul founded in 1976. At other times, they were published by Ron Paul and Associates. Now, finding the pre-1999 newsletters was not an easy thing for this writer to do. Was able to track a few of them down in the libraries of the University of Kansas and the Wisconsin Historical Society. But with few bylines, it's difficult to know whether any particular article was written by Paul himself. And this is the defense that Ron Paul has been offering when these newsletters were brought to light, that he, in fact, was not the author. Now, some of the earlier newsletters are signed by him, though the vast majority of the editions seen by this writer, James Kirchick of the New Republic, contain no bylines at all. Complicating matters, many of the unbylined newsletters were written in the first person, implying that Paul was the author. But whoever actually wrote them, the newsletters I saw all had one thing in common. They were published under a banner containing Paul's name, and the articles seemed designed to create the impression that they were written by him and reflected his views. What they reveal are decades of obsession with conspiracies, sympathy for the right-wing militia movement, and deeply held bigotry against blacks, Jews, and gays. In short, they suggest that Ron Paul is not the plain-speaking anti-war activist his supporters believe they are backing, but rather a member in good standing of some of the oldest and ugliest traditions in American politics. Yeah, pretty shocking stuff here. A strain of right-wing libertarianism that views the Civil War as a catastrophic turning point in American history, the moment when a tyrannical federal government established its supremacy over the states. Paul's alliance with neo-Confederates helps explain the views his newsletters have long espoused on race. Take, for instance, a special issue of the Ron Paul Political Report published in June 1992, which we quoted earlier, dedicated to explaining the Los Angeles riots, saying that the riots ended when the welfare checks came in. According to the newsletter, the looting was a natural byproduct of government indulging the black community with civil rights, quotas, mandated hiring preferences, set aside for government contracts, gerrymandered voting districts, black bureaucracies, black mayors, black curricula in schools, black TV shows, black TV anchors, hate crime laws, and public humiliation for anyone who dares question the black agenda. It also denounced the media for believing that America's number one need is an unlimited white checking account for underclass blacks. To be fair, the newsletter did praise Asian merchants in Los Angeles, but only because they had the gumption to resist political correctness and fight back. Koreans were the only people to act like real Americans, it explained, mainly because they have not yet been assimilated into our rotten liberal culture, which admonishes whites faced by raging blacks to lie back and think of England. Wow, this is unbelievable. The special issue on racial terrorism was hardly the first time one of Paul's publications had raised these topics. As early as December 1989, a section of his investment letter titled What to Expect for the 1990s predicted that racial violence will fill our cities because mostly black welfare recipients will feel justified in stealing from mostly white haves. 2 months later, a newsletter warned of the coming race war, and in November 1990, an item advised readers, if you live in a major city and can leave, do so. If not, but you can have a rural retreat for investment and refuge, buy it. In June 1991, an entry on racial disturbances in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C.'s Adams Morgan neighborhood was titled, Animals Take Over the D.C. Zoo. This is only the first skirmish in the race war of the 1990s, the newsletter predicted. In an October 1992 item about urban crime, the newsletter's author, presumably Paul, wrote, I've urged everyone in my family to know how to use a gun in self-defense, for the animals are coming. That same year, a newsletter described the aftermath of a basketball game in which blacks poured into the streets of Chicago in celebration. How to celebrate? How else? They broke the windows of stores to loot. The newsletter inveighed against liberals who want to keep white America from taking action against black crime and welfare, adding jury verdicts, basketball games, and even music are enough to set off black rage, it seems. Such views on race also inflected the newsletter's commentary on foreign affairs. South Africa's transition to multiracial democracy was portrayed as a destruction of civilization that was the most tragic to ever occur on that continent, at least below the Sahara. And March 1994, a month before Nelson Mandela was elected president, one item warned of an impending South African Holocaust. Now, this goes on for quite a long time, but just to cut to the chase here. When this writer asked Jesse Benton, Paul's campaign spokesman, about the newsletters, he said that over the years, Ron Paul had granted various levels of approval to what appeared in his publications, ranging from no approval to instances where he actually wrote it himself. And after I read Benton some of the more offensive passages, he said, a lot of the newsletters he did not see. Most of the incendiary stuff, no. He added that he was surprised to hear about the insults hurled at Martin Luther King because Ron thinks Martin Luther King is a hero. In other words, Paul's campaign wants to depict its candidate as a naive, absentee overseer with minimum knowledge of what his underlings were doing on his behalf. This portrayal might be more believable if extremist views had cropped up in the newsletters only sporadically, or if the newsletters had just been published for a short time, but it's difficult to imagine how Paul could allow material consistently saturated in racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and conspiracy mongering to be printed under his name for so long if he did not share those views. In that respect, whether or not Paul personally wrote the most offensive passages is almost beside the point. If he disagreed with what was being written under his name, you would think that at some point over the course of decades, he would have done something about it. And summing up here, from his newsletters, a different picture of Ron Paul emerges, that of someone who is either himself deeply embittered or for a long time allowed others to write bitterly on his behalf. His adversary is often described in harsh terms. Barbara Jordan is called Barbara Morandin. Eleanor Holmes Norton is Black Pinko. Donna Shalala is a short lesbian. Ron Brown is a racial victimologist. And Roberta Achtenberg, the first openly gay public official confirmed by the United States Senate, is a far-left, normal-hating lesbian activist. Maybe such outbursts mean Ron Paul is a straight talker, or maybe they just mean he is a man filled with hate. Now, hearing that, being presented with the actual evidence, I think it's enough to wake a lot of people up. I would hope so, but I still, when I tell otherwise intelligent people these things, I get the people change over the years thing. I don't think you can run for president after having said things like that without being expected to answer to them. I also don't think it's at all likely that newsletters were published under his name in his district where he lived, and he had no idea what was being said. What is true is that he never spoke out against them until they were brought to national attention recently. All right, that's Ron Paul for you. And if we find something like that on any of the other candidates, we'll certainly mention it. Okay, we only have a few minutes, so I'd like to take phone calls, 631-632-9872. What I'm going to do is jump into delay now so that we don't have to worry about jumping into delay when the phone calls start coming in. But please call in, especially if you're in a place like Virginia or Maryland or D.C. and you're voting in the primaries tonight. We'd like to hear about that. We'd like to hear about your feelings on Obama, feelings on Ron Paul, feelings on anything going on in this rather exciting time. Okay, let's head over to delay now.
This is Robert Klein speaking to you from WUSB, Stony Brook, New York. Get me out of here.
And we are in delay, and thanks for helping us get over there. 631-632-9872, that is our telephone number. And if there's anyone out there either listening to us in your car as the snow falls here on Long Island or on the internet, feel free to give us a call. I know the internet takes a little bit longer for the signal to get out there, so it might take you a little while to run to the phone. But we only have about 5 minutes left to take these phone calls. This is probably one of the more exciting times in this country's history, where it looks, the perception at least, is that change might be on the horizon. What I'd like to know is, are we hopelessly naive for thinking that? Are we hopelessly naive for hoping in the first place? Should we just resign ourselves to the fact that the new boss will be the same as the old boss, nothing really changes, and we should just go about our daily routines? You tell me. 631-632-9872. Good evening. You are on Off the Wall.
Yes. Hi, Emmanuel.
How you doing?
Hey. Driving in the snow, listening to the show, and just wanted to say that Barack Obama is definitely the candidate for America's future. I really think that he represents the best chance for change and hope, and also to show the world, you know, that we are capable as a people of, turning this thing around.
Uh-huh. What is it that appeals to you the most from his platform?
Basically that, you know, he is not part of the old mentality and the old guard. That it's kind of like, you know, the period when Kennedy was elected, where, mm-hmm. you know, you have all these old school, you know, candidates like McCain and even Clinton, they come with a lot of baggage attached to them from the past. And McCain is just wants to continue everything that George Bush has been doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. Anybody who would not lambaste George W. Bush for what he has done over the years, I don't think deserves to be considered at all. And as you say, McCain just wants to continue that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to talk about the war as something that, you know, is going to be won and has to be won, is just pretty, you know, damaged goods.
Uh-huh.
And his stand on you know, environmental issues in regards to building more coal-fired, you know, power plants and nuclear power plants, those are all things that, you know, as a nation, we need to look to alternatives and quickly. And I think Obama represents the best chance of putting the investment dollars into something that has a beneficial future for the United States, not stuff that's going to just drag us deeper into, environmental degradation and more,
uh-huh.
problems.
Now, here's what bothers me. I mean, Hillary Clinton would also be a vast improvement over the last 8 years, and she'd also be much better than John McCain. What concerns me about Hillary's campaign, and maybe this is through no fault of her own, I don't know, but it just seems like she inspires such opposition from various peoples, particularly Republicans. And what I think would happen is that a lot of people would turn out, people who aren't really enthused about John McCain, they would turn out mostly to vote against her. Whereas I don't see that kind of reaction against Obama. In fact, even people who are right-wing and conservative, I see them supporting this guy because he's young, he's different, he's reaching out to them, and I see a lot of right-wing people actually supporting him over McCain. I don't see anything like that for Hillary.
Absolutely. Hillary brings with it, you know, tremendous negative baggage, you know, and it's going to be almost a continuation of the years that Bill was in office, where Republicans basically had him on the ropes and on the run for the whole entire time of his presidency, under investigation and basically unable to, you know, do anything of great importance and usefulness because they were so hamstrung by, you know, the Republicans.
Who do you think would make a good vice presidential candidate for running mate, rather, for Obama? Any preferences?
Maybe Edwards.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. You know, a lot of people are talking about the dream ticket of Obama and Clinton. I don't see it because I see the two as just sort of taking the spotlight off each other and a lot of infighting. But Edwards, I liked almost everything Edwards said. And he has a really good personality, a very positive outlook, it seems. And that's going to count for something. Obama Edwards, I think that could win. That could win a lot of votes.
Especially the fact, you know, Edwards does have, you know, that same youthful, you know, and fresh idea, mm-hmm. Personality. And it would certainly be appealing to, I think, the same, you know, youth vote that's starting to wake up and try and get out there and support Obama and bring about change because they can see their future turning into, you know, this gigantic morass of how do you say, you know, it's just this nightmare,
mm-hmm.
you know,
absolutely.
Of regulation and warfare and continuous debt and a spiraling, you know, downward in your standard of living.
Yeah, sometimes just the perception of change is enough to actually start change for real, and that's what I'm hoping to see here. Listen, sir, we're out of time. Thanks for a very good conversation, and drive safe.
Have a night.
All right. All right, that's unfortunately all the time we have for calls tonight. But we will be back next week talking about this issue, I'm sure, and others. I'd like everybody to keep an eye on the TV set tonight. Yeah, I know TV is evil. Don't turn on the TV. Throw it out the window. But sometimes you have to pay attention to what's going on. I also know it's wrong for us to actually react with hope and think that something might change based on a mainstream candidate. But sometimes this kind of thing can happen. Sometimes you have to crawl out of your shell and make a change in a particular direction to make a bigger change down the road. I don't know. I get the feeling that a lot of people want to just kind of ignore the whole process. Not a lot of people, but a lot of people I know. And this isn't the right time for that. This is the time to actually pick the best of the people out there. Make up your mind on that. Maybe it's Ron Paul. Who knows? But at least have a good reason for it. All right. That's going to do it for us here tonight. Write to us, please. We'd like to get your mail and letters and things like that. otw@2600.com. I don't like the way that CD player sounds. I'm sorry. I got to stop this. No, out of general principle, it sounds distorted. It sounds overmodulated. And it's too good a song to play that way. So I'm going to... of course, this is going to hurt Finn because he has to start with the CD player that sounds all distorted. But I'm going to start with the good one. Okay, of course, it's got to load, and that's going to take a couple of seconds, too. Yes, write to us, otw@2600.com. That doesn't sound much better, does it? All right, I don't know what's going on here, but we'll be back again next week, distorted or not distorted. Keep paying attention. Let us know what goes on. otw@2600.com. Emmanuel Goldstein off the wall. Have a good night.
Tell it like it is. We gotta stop going so fast to figure out what's going on. Ooh, tell it how it is. I know there's lots wrong, but we gotta try to be together. Tell it like it is. We're like a ship barely afloat and we can't go on. Good things, I wanna come along. Tell it like it is. We're in a race against time. that we should never run. Tell it how it is. We gotta try and take that time to be together. Tell it like it is. I need to get it all straight and I can't wait too long. Tell it how it is. I wanna be around for the good things. I wanna be strong. Tell it like it is. Maybe I'm wrong. Tell it how it is. I wanna be strong.
Boned like a saint with the consciousness of a snake.
This is Lenny Kay from the Patti Smith Band. You're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM from Stony Brook, whence the Blue Oyster Cult originated.
One, two, three, four.